The church, we invite people to events, we invite people, you know, through spiritual conversations, hopefully, we invite them to accept Christ. That's, you know, very, very important. I am a Christ follower. I'm standing here today as your pastor because somebody invited our family to church. That was hugely significant. You know, anybody in your world that you are not at least trying to reach, at least have some spiritual conversations. Basically, and this may sound harsh, basically you're saying, hey, I know we act like we're friends, but I really don't care if you go to hell or not. I mean, let's just put it where it is. I know that sounds harsh, good, because I don't sound harsh very often. But that's the way I look at my friends. I look for opportunities. I try to create opportunities to share with them, whether they're here, there, or anywhere. It's just too important. The message of Christ is too important. Hillside's not as important as Christ is, of course. And that's why we're here to magnify the Lord. So that's one of the very, very important things. Now, one of the ways that we want to help you be able to have the ability to share with people and love people and care for people is really being able to set up environments for us to be able to love and care for each other. That's one of the reasons why we're doing the potluck today. Very, you know, very, very important. I was talking to a lady this week, actually a couple weeks ago, and she goes to a church. I'm very familiar with the church. It's over on the other side of the Bay Area. But I said, so that must be really great. I said, good Bible teaching. She goes, oh, yeah, great Bible teaching. And so as we talked, I realized she doesn't ever go there. She just watches it online. And they get the family together at random times, and they watch it. And I thought, you know, they're getting some good teaching, but they're missing the really most important part, and that's the interacting. You know, I know I've had people say, more than one person say, that the highlight of the whole church service is just what we did, just being able to hug each other, see each other, you know, and that's why we're having this potluck afterwards. Everybody's invited to stay. We're just going to hang out and have lunch. It's not any agenda. It's not a meeting. It's not a teaching. It's just having some fun together. I'll never forget, you know, just looking as my kids accepted Christ, you know, Janelle, Cindy and I did not lead Janelle to Christ, you know, our oldest. We didn't lead her to Christ, and she didn't, you know, walk forward during a service. It wasn't like, Dad, that message that you preached touched my heart. So, you know, no. You know what it was? It was down in a small group downstairs. One teacher who had this tiny little group of people, and they just talk and would share, and she let, you know, she led Janelle to Christ right down, right, I take you to the room, right, one of those little tucked away rooms down there. Betty Hagberg led her to Christ. And, you know, none of my kids have said, oh, Dad, it was just the incredible service, or, oh, the band was so good, I just had to accept Jesus. Very, very few times do I have people do that. Now, there's people that will accept Christ sitting here, and I'll help them as I lead a prayer or whatever, but growth really happens, you know, in circles. I love rows. Now, you all come, and I mean, I'd like to have a job, you know. I have a job, and you guys come, and you sit in rows, and I talk to you, and you listen, and so forth, and I love that. But real significant growth happens in circles, and that's what we're gonna talk about a little bit today. We look at Jesus, and he would go out and preach to thousands and thousands and do all these miracles, but he always had those times when he took the disciples back, always, and he would talk to them. Sometimes he would just take a few of them, and they would have moments together, and then he would take the 12, and he'd go set aside, and he'd talk, and he'd say, hey, do you understand what I really said? And they usually go, you know, they didn't know, and so he would explain to them what was happening, and what was it? Sure, there were big, massive people, but then there was those circles. And so we're going to, you know, thinking about what brings the most life change into our lives. Now, here's the blessing and the curse of the small church. Blessing is we know each other. We're pretty familiar with each other. The curse is if we forget somebody's name, we're really embarrassed to go up and ask them, right? Because it's like, hey, we're only got 100 people here. I mean, I should be able to know everybody's name. And so we're afraid to do that. Also, we make an assumption that because we're small, that we really know each other. And we're really helping each other and growing each other. And we hug each other and love each other. That's not the problem. But we take for granted this atmosphere, and we think that we really are growing deep when really it's just that we're very familiar with each other. If we were in a church, you know, of 20,000 people, we wouldn't make that assumption. We would walk and go, well, there's no way to get to know all these people. Man, how do you get connected? And then we go, oh, I guess I should get in a small group. And that makes a lot of sense. But to church our size, sometimes we can take this, you know, for granted. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that when we think of what brings life change, I've never wanted to have a church where there are lots and lots of fans. You know what I mean? I've never, in my 25 years, going on 25 years here, I've never set number goals necessarily, but I wanted this church to be a family. No matter how big or how small or whatever size, I wanted it to feel like a family. I've never wanted people to just simply attend. I wanted people to attach. It always makes me sad when I see people come in, they kind of tuck away, and then they zip out, you know, right after the offering, right before I can really, you know, say, hey, I'm glad you're here, you know, slip out. That always makes me kind of sad a little bit. I never wanted to create a mindset where people would go to church, you know? I mean, I wanted us always to be a place where we could grow. Not just go, but also to grow. And I've learned over the years that you don't really grow in rows as much. You learn. There's a lot of things you can do. You can accept things that you can accept Christ in rows. You can be challenged in rows. You can learn in rows. You can make decisions in rows. You can feel in rows. But to really grow, your best, some of you who have experienced this, some of your best growth has happened in relationship. Now, I'm all for rows, but real spiritual maturity happens in the context of relationship. Now, me as your pastor and the leadership team, we love you so much. We have been taking painstaking steps to try to do this. In fact, let me be honest with you. Here's the irony of this whole thing. This idea of community and us joining together and small groups and us being able to really grow together is so important to us. Sometimes we've overthought it. Sometimes because we want so much, because it's so important, we want to be so careful. Sometimes we've delayed it, sometimes unnecessarily. And we've overthought it at times. But we know how important this is. And so I want to just tell you, why does it help? Why does it help when we're in smaller settings, when we're in smaller groups? I love that the youth group, I've seen them sometimes when I've poked my head in, and they'll be sometimes on the stage, and they'll be, you know, like all bundling up, kind of like they're huddling. During vacation Bible school, we had the big things, and their kids are running around, whatever, but there was this time when they really had this small little setting, and they'd be sitting here, and they would be telling, what are they afraid of, and what do they see God doing, you know, and Dean did a great job up here, you know, where did you see God, evidences of God today, and that's where growth was really happening. See, in circles, what happens is we experience accountability. And I want to tell you, especially if those of you who are guests, inside your bulletin, there's a little insert, a little listening guide thing, if you'd like to pull that out. But in circles, we experience accountability. Now, why is that important? Why that's important is simply this, right under number one. You can skip that to now the little dot. Doing is what makes the difference, not learning. Doing is what makes the difference, not learning. So that's very, very important. So first, circles, you experience that accountability where people really know what's going on with you. And again, as a small church, we know each other's names, but we sometimes don't know what's going on with each other. Again, giant churches don't assume that, but the truth is knowing each other's names and sitting together doesn't mean we're accountable to each other, does it? You could still come Sunday after Sunday, and then you can call your mom and you can say, hey, I was in church. And oh, I'm so proud of you, honey. Right? And or your mother-in-law, whatever, whoever's keeping track of you. And you know, you may learn some things, but not necessarily do. James talks about that. You can hear the word, but where's your life? The life change. And sometimes having those people who love us around us to care, that accountability. Doing is what makes the difference, not learning. Also, another thing in circles is there's a sense of belonging. And I think that's one of the things that we really enjoy here, is that we, you know, most of us that have been here for at least a little while feel like, you know what, that's my church. That's, you know, this is where I belong. But in circles, you also can really experience true caring. Because we're a smaller church, it's always amazing. People, I did, you know, some hospital calls. I do hospital calls a lot, but I'm always amazed when people say, "Wow, you still do hospital calls?" And I say, "Well, of course I do," because a lot of people don't. And it's not because pastors don't care about people in the hospital. It's just that it's not practical, and you don't find out things a lot of times. It's kind of like, you know, the boss, you know, or mothers, last one to know. You know, that's the way you feel. And so sometimes I've literally had people go into the hospital, have surgery, heal before I've even heard about it. So, you know, but that never happens when you have a close group of friends, does it? When you're doing community together, when you're in circles, the best care stories are not me showing up at the hospital or going to somebody's house. That's not the best stories that I hear. The really great ones are when people in the community. And I've gone in where I've, you know, going to go visit somebody. I walk in, and here's people from Hillside just standing there. And it's like, it doesn't get any better than this. People really loving and caring. So as I go through this, what are the things I want us to look at? It's a couple of goals that I have for all of us. And I hope all of us can be a part of this. And you say, but wait a minute, it's my first Sunday. I've only been here a couple of times. I would love to have you be a part of this as well. First of all, I would love for everybody to get in a group. We're going to, you know, we've got some groups that are starting back up. You know, a lot of things take a break in the summer. Now we got some things starting back up now that school's getting going. September, kind of a nice time to start, you know, right after Labor Day, get things going again. So I want you to get in a group. If you're already in a group, and some of you are in a group, I want your group to get going. The Salazars have a group. You'll be hearing about that in a little bit. And our leadership small group, they took the summer off. But fall's coming. It's a great time to get started, to get going. Now, I can't tell you how much I wish I could get up here and tell you how small groups and being in one over the years has changed my life. I wish I could do that. Because sometimes I'm able to share lessons where I've, you know, this has been a pattern in my life, and I can say, well, for the last, you know, 40 years, this is what I've done. This is not one of those situations. This is a lesson. This is something in my life I have just discovered in very recent years, the value of it. And so I can't get up here and say, look, I've done this right, and here's how you do it. This is one of those things where I just have to say, I've only realized the value in recently, and it has made all the difference. As I mentioned, our leadership team, we had our regular leadership meetings, but we also just decided, let's form a small group. Let's be a small group and encourage each other and share with each other. Before my last message in our series Future Family, some of you were here for that, I asked my girls if I had done anything, or what I had done, if anything, that I did right as a dad. You know, and I said, I'm not asking you to make up stuff. I'm not asking for, you know, compliments. I just really want to know, what was it that you felt like we did right? And everything with regard to their spiritual life had nothing to do with my sermons. Had nothing to do with that. Everything else was in a family or small setting, you know. And I want to just say to you I'm not an empty nester yet. Stephanie doesn't know, but we're not letting her leave ever. So, ever. But the truth of it is that, you know, I look back and there are opportunities that come that never will come again. And it's encouraging to me to be able to talk to some of you young people who, you know, aren't married yet or just about to get married. Because opportunities come, opportunities go, and you can't go back. And if you don't get your kids, for example, if you don't get your kids involved in the children's ministry or in youth group, once you get past that point, you can't look back and go, wow, that would have been a good idea, but it doesn't really make that much difference. It makes a huge difference. It makes a huge difference. It will affect their future. It is a common trend for young people, the 20-somethings that we've got here. I love them because I'll tell you, that age group is ditching church. Not God, and not even spirituality. Okay, it's not like they're saying, we hate God, we hate Jesus, we're out of here. But it's just like, church is like, what's the value of it? You know, we could probably get together, and they are seeing the value of community, but what's happened? They're not seeing the value of being together. I mean, it's a Bible command. Don't forsake the assembling of yourself together, right? I mean, we know, okay, that's, you know, Bible, and we heard messages on it when those of us who grew up in church growing up, you know, and it just meant, you know, we translated that as every time the church doors were open, we had to be there, you know. But not so much. And I'm telling you, we want to partner. When I say we, I'm talking about myself, the leadership of all of those, the children's workers, the nursery workers, the youth workers, you know, we all want to help anchor your kids in truth. Give them a foundation. Give them a foundation in faith. Give them a foundation in theology. Now, that's a big word, but that's just, you know, the study of God and how he works. And we want to help you build an anchor so strong that when they drift, they only drift. Okay? You hear what I'm saying? Because they've been anchored. In fact, we're revamping our children's ministry. We've spent a great deal of time, a good amount of time at our last leadership meeting. We're revamping it, and I am so excited about some stuff we're going to be offering to the children's ministry. But those of you who minister the kids, if you worked at VBS or you minister the kids, would you just raise your hand? I don't want to embarrass you, but I just, okay. I cannot thank you enough. I really cannot thank you enough. That's where the cutting edge of ministry is in children's work. You know, we sometimes look at it as a necessary evil. It's like we plan all these things like, oh, yeah, and then we got to have something for the kids because what are the parents going to do with the kids? No, I think the opposite of that, you know. It's like I want to have something creative for the parents so that they'll have to bring the kids. Because I'll tell you, that's so important. Now, here's something that's kind of interesting. Here's something. Little kids love playing with each other, right? Little kids love to get together and play. They have playtimes and they play, you know, interacting. They have playgrounds, right? Do teens like to hang out with each other? Maybe, right? College age, I mean, they're looking for opportunities, right? They establish groups. They establish sororities so that they can be together. I mean, you know, kids, teenagers, college age, they have no problem socializing. And then we get to be adults and something happens to us. Yeah, maybe that's it. No playgrounds, right? No playgrounds with big enough swings. I don't know what it is, but something's wrong. And there's something inside of us that just all of a sudden, it's like, oh, I just want peace and quiet. I don't want to see people. I want to get away from people. And it's kind of a sad thing. Now, I want to say to us as adults, by the way, one of the most difficult times to be in a small group is when your kids are teenagers. One of the most difficult times for a lot of reasons. But let me tell you, I think that's one of the most important times for your kids to be able to see you in a small group, valuing a small group. Why? Well, first of all, they think you're crazy, you know? You think you're going crazy, and you know they're crazy, and it's just there's a lot, and it is so helpful to be able to sit in a home, be able to sit in a circle, talk to people who are maybe a step or two beyond you, and for them to say, look, you're gonna make it. Even having parents go, you know what, my son did that, my daughter did that, oh yeah, they went through that, you know, and of course your question is, do they ever come out of it? And it's like, you will live to tell this story. And sometimes it's just helpful to be able to, you know, to be able to have that. Now, I want to say, this message I want to share with you, this is not promoting a church program, okay? Or a Sunday school, or some kind of gimmick, or whatever. This is, I love you, and I care about you enough about your spiritual life that I know what can really help make a difference. Now, I want to address the group that is probably most often resistant to this kind of thing. Most resistant to getting in a small group, and I'm a part of that group, and that's the group of us guys. Now, ladies, we're going to let you listen in, and some of you, this is going to apply to very well, especially if you're a woman who happens to be a leader, if you happen to be in the world of business, or you're a leader, especially if you're an executive of some kind. Some of this is going to overlap, but so I'm going to pick on the guys, and then girls, you can kind of glean what you want. But I want to tell you, because I mean, this includes you single guys, yeah, college guys, about to get married guys, retired guys, you know, guys in their 50s and 60s who, like me, say, hey, I don't need any friends. You know, now, and I'm sorry if I sound a little stereotypical. I am sharing a lot from my heart, and I'm going to share a lot of stuff that I feel and that I struggle with. Maybe you don't. You may walk out of here and go, wow, does he got issues? He probably should be on he should probably be on medication and double up on his therapy or something. But the truth of it is, I'm going to just share with you how I think some tendencies that we guys have, and then you ladies can be of help, you know, to us perhaps. But I think you'll glean some. And again, ladies, if I sound kind of sexist, or, you know, if you say, well, he's talking about guys, I struggle with that. You know, I don't mean to be offensive at all if you are that way. So I live with all girls, and every girl I've ever known, maybe with the exception of my older sister, who is hiking the entire Pacific Coast Trail from Mexico to Canada by herself. and she's, and one of her little messages she sent to me, she goes, I've discovered something on this trip. I actually do like people. So, except for her, all the girls I know have this natural inclination. You know, girls' nights out, I've never had a guy's night out. You know, I've never done that. You know, but they just seem to have a natural affinity for socializing and connecting and all of that. And so, but for most of us guys, our tendency is this. And I'm right in there with you. I don't want you to feel like I'm theorizing. A lot of this I just pulled out from my heart. Is that we tend to drift toward isolation, independence, and autonomy. Guys, am I okay? Right? Now, this may not be every man, and some women may feel this, you know, included in this, but I know this is true of most men. In fact, I don't even know if we drift. I think we want it. I don't think that is even a good word. I think we seek it. I think there are, you know, several reasons for this. If you're a business guy, if you're a person in business or any line of work, you know, you've seen those stories where the 40-year-old, the 40-something, you know, buys a company, tweaks it, and then, you know, sells it for millions and millions and walks away. I had a couple of friends, two different guys that I coached soccer with. Both of them in their 40s, independently wealthy. One of them didn't even have to work a day in his life anymore. He just like, okay, you know, got it all. And had this goal of building the most giant house in the area, which he did. Okay, whatever. And you think, man, all he did was this and this, and he had this idea. Why didn't I think of that? Of course, your wife's going, yeah, why didn't you think of that? You know, and or I had that idea a long time ago. And he's like, yeah, well, if you hadn't, you know, sat on your duff, then maybe this would, you know, whatever. But then, of course, we watch their lives, and we're not so sure that it would be worth the exchange because their lives look pretty miserable, you know, even though they may seem, make us believe they're happy. But we hear those stories, and we see these people who become autonomous, they become independent, they could become self-sufficient, self-directed, you know, it's, you know, most of us walk into an atmosphere and it's like, what do I have to do today? We got a list of stuff. Wouldn't it be nice just to wake up and go, I wonder what I want to do today? And we just have this list, and no, we don't have a list at all, right? Because we've got it all together. This whole technology and app thing, this messes with your mind, doesn't it? I mean, I was just reading about some of these things. Now, a guy by the name of Gentry Underwood created this little mailbox app that thought, may I make my email a little bit easier? He's on the App Store 37 days, my friends, 37 days, and sells it off to Dropbox for $100 million. That's not a bad day's work, if you ask me. All right? That's a month well invested, wouldn't you say? Some of you, now you young people, Snapchat, you've heard of Snapchat? You know the CEO and co-founder of that's 23 years old. Yeah, not bad. Not too long ago, turned down, I think it was just the end of last year, turned down an offer for $3 billion, with a B, dollars. And people are saying that he made the right decision because he's going to get a lot more money for it. And, you know, there's $3 billion, you know. And then the one I love too, you know, some of you kids saving for college, right? Some of you teenagers got to get that money together for college. There was a young guy, 17 years or 15 years old, when he developed this little app. He learned how to code, was writing this app, 17 years old, just sold his app to Yahoo for $30 million. I think he's going to be able to put himself through college pretty well. You know, I think he'll be fine. And I'm still trying to figure out how to load an app. Right? It's like, did I just delete that? I see a cloud next to it, but I thought I owned it. But what do I do now? You know, I'm panicked. And here's these 17-year-olds creating it and selling it. And some of us, we sit there and go, is my life ever going to have meaning? Am I really ever going to get to a point? And then, you know, you see these kids, these young kids, and they're driving your car. They're driving your dream car. And they're parking it next to your other dream car. Right, guys? Because we got more than one. And it's just like, are you kidding me? And just a little sideline. What's with the black cars? You know, these guys, these young kids, they buy these black cars, and you're driving along, and you see these really, you know, these 23-year-old kids who sold an app for $30 million, and they got this black car. It's the middle of the spring. All the pollen's all over. Black car, not a bit of pollen on their car. The rest of us are 3 inches deep in pollen, no pollen on their black car. What's with that? You know, don't you want to feel, don't you want to be autonomous and self-sufficient enough that you've got people that make sure you don't have pollen all over your car, you know? And I'm having some fun with that, but you know, that idea of independence, self-sufficiency. Now, let me just say this, because it sounds so worldly and fleshly and horrible, I don't think it's all bad. I could probably make a case for how some of this is a reflection of God's thumbprint on our life, that we have direction, we have purpose, that we want to accomplish things. You know, I think that's there. But then there's something else in us guys that we have to deal with, and you ladies have to live with sometimes. And that's once you get in your 30s, 40s, you know, in your early 50s, there's this kind of low-grade anger. And your wife or your friends and your family ask you, what are you so mad about? And I know what you're mad about. You're mad because you're not that guy. That you've been working as hard as you've been working, but you're not in that situation. All of a sudden, you know, life starts to look the same. And now instead of you know, looking at life in terms of seasons, you're looking at life in terms of years. You know, it's Christmas time now. It's summer. Now it's Christmas again. Wow, now it's summer again. And it's just like, where is life going? And there's this discontentment, and let me tell you who you're unhappy with. You're unhappy with you. But you're making everybody else around you unhappy because you make them feel like it's their fault. You make it feel like it's them. But listen, if you're not happy with your wife, if you're not happy with your kids, and you're not happy with your car, you're not happy with you. You're not happy with you. You know why? Because you picked her, you raised them, and you bought it. I mean, right? It's our fault. It's your, yeah. And there's a part of us as guys that we struggle with this. And there's kind of this anger and this jealousy and this, and it's so conflicting, and it's hard to say good things about other successful people, and you don't like that about yourself. And some of you are sitting there saying, wow, Pastor David, that must be great because you're a pastor and you would never, ever, ever have to struggle with that. I am so deep in here with you, it's crazy. And you know what happens when we have that underlying anger? Anger isolates. And sometimes we'll even use our anger to isolate. It always does. And we tend to lean toward isolation anyway. Then we've got this anger that, you know, thing going on anyway. And we become more reclusive, and you extroverts, you deal with this even in your own different way. You have it, but you deal with it maybe. One of the other things I think that facilitates this is that if we're in business, now some of you, you know, you have a business or you work in a company or maybe you work in real estate or whatever. Here's one of the things that we struggle with is we get to a point when we meet people, we see everybody as either a client, a customer, or a contact. Right? If you're in sales or if you're in business or you have a company or like in real estate, it's like everybody's either a client, a customer, or contact. So, and you know, I'll just tell you the pastor version of this. Oh, hi, hey, glad to meet you. Oh, you know Christ, that's awesome. Oh, you go to a church. All right, hey, nice to meet you, you know. Right? I'm telling you, and that's horrible, and we hate it. But we know if we think about it long enough, we can look at that. We want everything to connect with every relationship. Every relationship starts to have an agenda. So it's hard for us to actually be in genuine community without an agenda. I've told you this before. You know, my wife has sometimes planned little social events for us, and I'll go, now, why are we doing this? What's the purpose of this? She'll say, for fun. Write this down. Write this down. Get your pencil out. The blank there, fun, you know. And it's like, oh, I don't see how this is going to benefit my life, you know, just doing something for fun. Community. It's hard to be in community. And again, sometimes if you're one of those people struggling with this low-grade anger, this jealousy or whatever, it's like, you know, hey, I'm not going over to their house. I know what their house looks like. And they're certainly not coming over to mine because they'll probably think things about mine. And man, you throw that all together and we just become a mess. And something I struggle with, maybe you struggle with this too, but something I struggle with is we get to a point sometimes where we feel like everybody wants something. Gail and I were talking about layoffs and corporations going on. It's like, that's increasing because, you know, as the people in your place of employment, as the number goes down, the expectations for you go up, right? And everybody wants a piece of you. And you feel like, oh, I'm just so drained. And, you know, and I can have 1,000 fans and no friends, you know, boo-hoo. Actually, I don't care, which is part of the problem, right? The whole isolation thing. You can get to a place where you feel like anybody who walks up to you just wants something. And what does that do? It pushes us further. It's like, oh, I just want to get away. And guys, our best friend becomes the remote control because it's not going to ask anything of us, you know? So, it's like, hey, if it's not going to benefit me, if it's not a means to an end, then forget it. Besides, I'm not that happy with myself, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go and see them. I don't want them to come and see me, and I could never really be in that kind of a situation. And it gets weird. And our weirdness draws us to unhealthy relationships, unhealthy situations, I should say. So guys, ladies, I hope you're okay with this talking here. Guys, I want us to get in community, okay? It's one of the most difficult things. Now, many of you guys see me as a social person, as a person, you know, this would be a piece of cake for me. This is so hard for me. To really enjoy some community, with the leadership that I love and work with and lead with, it was so hard. But we're going to do everything we can to help you. And you're just going to have to get to a point where we say, I'm not going to get sucked into the vortex of manhood and that whole comparison thing and all that anger. Just don't get into it. So now, what I want to do is I want to quickly tell you a Bible story. I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm just going to read some selected verses just to kind of share this Bible study story with you. Make a simple point and then share with you just some opportunities. And I know that this is going to help you be a better leader. It's going to help you be a better father, a better husband. It's something your kids, you say, hey, my kids are gone. You be a better grandparent, a better example to your adult children. We'll talk about that in just a second. But if you're single, by the way, you've got stuff to work on. And let me just tell you, there are things that you aren't going to work on until you get married. Don't do that. Don't wait. Because it's not very fun to work on some of that stuff when you're married. Get it worked on, and then when you get married, then it'll be all fun. So what you need, some of you single guys, and I know Chris has got a group of guys, you still have a group of guys, where, you know, some guys could sit around a circle, and a guy can look at the other guy and go, dude, do you always do that? Man, you got to stop that. Man, you drive people nuts doing that, right? And then, because some of you have had this happen, some of you married guys have had this happen. After you got married, yeah, we're married for a little while, and people came up to you and go, you know, you're a lot nicer now that you got married, right? Right? Why? Well, you know, she's kind of working on us and, you know, getting us to where we should be. So this is a very famous story. Even if you're not a Bible person, you may have heard of this story already. It's a story of David and Bathsheba. Now, when you get to heaven and see David, don't mention this. This is embarrassing to him. We can read it and talk about it. Go with the David and Goliath thing. You're David and Goliath, right? Nice to meet you. This is kind of embarrassing for him, I'm sure. We talk about how, you know, oh, God doesn't remember our sins. Yeah, he does. Here it is. That way, poor David's got him logged for us, and we study it and preach on it. And, you know, God's not up in heaven going, you know, David and Bathsheba, David and who? You know, he remembers. But good news, God can remember our sins, but he doesn't hold them against us. and he puts them away and they're removed, and that's what's so awesome. So I would encourage you to read this whole story when you get a chance. This is intense. This is awesome, and you can learn a lot. 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 2 through 4. One evening, David, now he's the king. Interesting detail. I should just tell you this right off the bat. When this took place, David was about 50. Okay? You see pictures of him. He looks like this just, you know, model 25-year-old, you know. No, he's in his 50s. He's not some 25-year-old wide-eyed person out looking for naked women on the balcony. He's been a king for over 20 years, 13 of them over the whole nation. But he's been a king for, you know, for over 20 years. And so he's grown. He's an adult, 50 years old. One evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. And David sent someone to find out about her. The man, David's servant, said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam," which I just have to tell you, if Eliam is her father, then her grandfather was one of David's most trusted advisors. So she's not part of the family, but her grandfather gave David some pretty amazing advice when David was younger, you know. So that's, there's a real connection. The daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah. Now, it's not Uriah. Who's Uriah? Uriah was one of David's friends. He obviously just never met Bathsheba, but he was a friend, and he was this kind of a friend. He was on a list of mighty men that David had fought with, had battled with, who had confided in. He is one of the guys. Uriah was one of the guys that helped David, the shepherd boy, become David the king. So this is a very significant guy. He's a close friend. They'd fought together. They'd risked their lives together. He says she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Then David sent messengers to get her. He blows it. And you know how the story goes from what we read later. And I don't believe this was just a one-time incident from what we read later. I think it's an ongoing thing. Called her the next night, and called her the next night, and maybe skipped a night, and called her the night after that, and you know. And by the way, this was no secret. He sends messengers. And slaves, they didn't keep secrets. Slaves talked to each other, who talked to other slaves. In fact, this was in this environment and time, if you wanted to get something out, you know, they didn't have like a newspaper, you told a slave. And the slaves would network, and then they'd go to the market, and they would tell other slaves in the market, and I'll tell you, boom, this spread like wildfire. And we always kind of think of it as something secret that nobody but David and Bathsheba and God knew about. Everybody knew. And he sent messengers, plural, to get her, and her neighbors certainly knew. I mean, the king's committing adultery with his advisor's granddaughter, and, you know, the wife of a friend, and then she finds out and sends a message. As, you know, things go along, I'm pregnant. Uh-oh. And apparently there's no doubt in David's mind at all that it's his. He has no doubt at all. That which means that's one of the things that tells me it probably was a repeated thing. There was certainly no doubt in her mind. So David does what every man knows you gotta do. That's control the outcome. Isn't that one of our tendencies? Control the outcome. We do some stupid things to do this. And this is, you know, we try to do this. We make plans. So David makes plans. He says, I need to get Uriah home so that he can go be with his wife, if you know what I mean, and then, you know, think that the baby is his. Problem solved. David sends messages out to the field where the war is happening, tells Joab, his commander of the army, hey, send Uriah home. And I'm sure Uriah's confused when David starts with all this small talk. So, how's Joab? Commander of the army, and how's it going out there? How are the soldiers doing? And Uriah's going, how's the battle going? And we're killing them. You know, how would a battle go? You don't take one of your soldiers for information. You send messengers back and forth. The messengers look, they can get reports. So I'm sure he's a little bit confused as to what's going on here, you know? Again, he's thinking, how's the war going? We're killing people. That's how it's going, you know? Control the outcome. Control the outcome. That's key. So David gets up next morning. He goes, hey, go enjoy your wife. You know, say hi. You know, I know I'll be sending you back, but just go. And he's thinking, he's been out there in the battle a long time. He'll take a shower. He'll enjoy his wife and all that. Wakes up the next morning and David finds out that he slept outside by the gates. Right by the palace gates, which basically meant he was there with the palace guards. Uriah spent the night with the people who were paid to take care of David, to protect David. So David's frustrated. He goes, hey, how come you didn't get home? Why didn't you go home, you know, to your wife? And Uriah says, hey, I can't go home. The rest of my army is there in battle. I'm not going to go home and enjoy my wife and have, you know, the comforts of home. So David says, okay, stay one more night, and then I'll send you back in the morning. And David says, hey, come to dinner. I got a big whole meal planned for you. I really appreciate all you do. And he gets him drunk. You know, read the Bible. It's kind of crazy. He gets him drunk. But Uriah still wouldn't go home to his wife. I mean, even drunk, he just, you know, hey, he stays right there by the palace gates once again. David gets up the next morning, and the fact is, just shows that Uriah was a much better man than David. So then David does the unthinkable, because he can't control his outcome, but he must control the outcome. So David writes a note to Joab, and he tells Joab, and hands it to Uriah. Uriah literally carries his own death sentence. He says, give this to Joab as soon as you get back. And here's what the note said. Dear Joab, he said, put Uriah out in front where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die. Outcome controlled. So there's talk, and everybody knows what's going on. But here's why you need to read the whole story. And here's the great tragedy in a practical sense from this story. Here are two dots David never connects together. In fact, they are two dots as men we have a hard time connecting. David permanently ruined his credibility and moral authority with his adult children. Never again did he have any authority. No, never again could he say to the kids, stay pure, kids. Stay true to your wife. He at this point, he loses all credibility with his adult children. They aren't dumb. Uriah dies in battle. Bathsheba's mourning, which the common amount of time was, they talk about a time of mourning, was 7 days. And then David mysteriously brings her into the palace and marries her. And lo and behold, they conceive immediately. In fact, before immediately. And right after the wedding, I mean, people knew. And David has these adult children from several different wives. And I'm sure they're like, Dad, come on. Are you serious? You have more wives than you could want. You have concubines. And you have a guy killed so that you can take this one woman and you commit immorality. And are you kidding me? The Bible said, we know it's hard to tell, but we know David had at least 7 wives and he had at least 10 concubines. And boy, that could be a TV show, couldn't it? But David permanently loses something he could never get back. Outcome, out of control. Then the part of the story we often don't get to is in the next chapter in 2 Samuel 12. It says, the Lord sent Nathan to David. Now, Nathan's a prophet, and no one else has this kind of access to David. David's the king. Everybody, he's just telling everybody what to do, and they just obey him. He tells them what to do, and they do it. No one's going to argue or reprimand the king. The king says to his messengers, I want you to go get Uriah's wife. The messengers aren't going to go, you know, king, let's talk about this. I don't think this is a good idea. You know, let's just, why don't you rethink this? No messenger is going to do that. Why? Because he wants to live, basically. And so God sends Nathan, the prophet, to David because no one has access to him. And check this out, man. Everybody around David got a paycheck from David. No one had access to David. Nobody felt like they could really be upfront, in his face, honest with him, and really share their heart. God had to send somebody from the outside because he's isolated. And when you're isolated, you're inaccessible. And men, and ladies too, but you understand, in most of us, not all of us, but most of us, it's part of our goal to be isolated sometimes. And consequently, if we're not careful, we become inaccessible. Now, this isn't an IQ test, but when we're inaccessible, do we make better decisions or worse decisions? We make terrible decisions. I make terrible decisions by myself. So, you know, King David, who had killed Goliath, who practically heard the voice of God, made a horrible decision because it was inaccessible. And so God sent Nathan, or else he wouldn't have been able to be confronted. Nathan presented this. And when he talks to David, he gives like a scenario, kind of like he's talking about a court case. He goes, "Hey, I want to talk to you about something." It says, "When he came to him, he said, 'There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor.'" And he tells David about this poor man and his family who had one little pathetic sheep, but the sheep was so loved by him. I mean, he ate out of their very plates and slept with them. It was, you know, that doesn't happen today. None of you have a cat or a dog that you treat like a person. I know that. I see the guilty smiles. All right. But that's the way this little sheep was. It was like a member of the family. Well, one day this rich guy, who's got lots of cattle, lots of sheep, got a whole bunch of stuff, a guest stops by. And he's thinking, "Oh, man, I don't want to have to go all the way out to the fields and get one of my sheep, whatever. This guy's got this one sheep, little sheep here. I'm going to go take that from him." And he steals that sheep and kills it and makes a meal out of it. And, you know, and then Nathan's basically saying, "So, King, you got any thoughts, you know, about this whole thing?" Look at this, verse 5. David loses it. David burned with anger against the man. He loses it. You know what? Right here in my kingdom? Now think about it. Who is David really mad at? David's mad at David. Because watch this. He knows what he's doing, and he knows he's got guilt. God's convicting him of this. He's carrying this anger inside. He goes, and he said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die." Time out, David. I mean, the guy did a really bad thing stealing sheep, but you don't kill somebody for stealing a sheep. I mean, maybe he has to repay him or whatever. But wow. Yep, that man must die. And then David's all flustered probably. And he goes, yeah. And he's got to pay the poor guy back, you know, four times. And of course, you read this and go, "Well, now, is that before he dies or after he dies?" You know, so he's just throwing out all the stuff. It's just like every possible punishment, just let him have it. And the truth is, when you and I carry around this kind of guilt and this kind of anger, you're going to overreact. You're going to point fingers. I mean, he's a little extreme here, wouldn't you say? Stole the sheep, you know, off of his head. Then Nathan said to David, "You are the man." The guy in the story, that's you. "And the Lord had to send me to you because you are not accessible to anybody. And because no one has access to you, look what you've done. You've embarrassed yourself. You've ruined your relationship with your adult children. And you've made this huge, huge mess." And Nathan says, "Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes?" And Nathan walks him through what, you know, all of the things that he's done. David sins, and then David responds. Then David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And God forgave him, but it did not erase the consequences of his isolation. Nobody tells me what to do. I'm the king. Yeah, stupid decision. Every one of us, me included, put me at the top of the list. Every one of us has the potential to do that kind of stupid thing if we just isolate ourselves, think we've got it together, think we can do it ourselves, you know, think we're the king, you know, in a sense. And David never, ever recovered his family from this. He never got his family back. God forgave him, but there's a difference between forgiveness and the consequences. Forgiveness is simple. It is very, very costly, but we don't have to pay the price thanks to Jesus. It's very costly. Consequences, on the other hand, for the most part, are here to stay. David and Bathsheba's baby dies. His family is a mess. His sons go to war with each other. One son kills another son. Then David has to go to war with one of his sons. Then his favorite son, Absalom, dies. But before Absalom dies, he mocks his father by taking all of King David's concubines up on the roof where he had seen Bathsheba, has sex with all of them in the middle of the day where everybody can see, has this big orgy on top of the roof. And David sees these constant reminders. Absalom, his favorite son, is killed in battle. This is horrible. But who's going to tell David no, right? He's the king. No one had access. Now, that's all interesting, but the reason why I tell you all that story is to tell you the foreshadowing of all this, the beginning of all this. The beginning of this story starts with, no, 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 don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. We read the first verse in this section, and we can almost tell what's coming. You read the story, you almost see what's going to happen, because here's the part I skipped. The entire narrative begins with this, 2 Samuel 11:1. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, a time when kings are supposed to go to war. That's what they're supposed to do. If you're a king, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to leave and go off to war. Spring, why spring? Spring because the crops have been taken in. That's all taken care of. The mud's dried, so it's easier to travel. Springtime because it's easier to, you know, to travel and you've got food enough to be able to pay, you know, to give to all of your armies. At the proper time, this was the time when kings go to war. It says, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. But David remained in Jerusalem. And the point here I want you to see is this, is that David got into trouble because he isolated himself from the community of men to whom he was most accessible. What do I mean by that? David didn't get into trouble because he was tempted. Everybody gets tempted. David didn't get himself in trouble because there was some beautiful woman. There was lots of beautiful women. Right? He got into trouble because he purposely, with a single decision, isolated himself from the only group that really had access to him. See, when men went off to war, there was this camaraderie. Some of you, you know, have contacts with people that you were in wars with. You know, it's just like, it's amazing that camaraderie that happens. And when kings go off to war, they're much more accessible. When kings went off and spent time with those who fought and bled for them and watched their friends die, there was a camaraderie and an accessibility like no other. And in that moment when David should have made a decision that would have kept him in community with that group, he decided, you know what, I don't do that anymore. I'm getting too old for this. You know, that's what I got a commander for. Let the younger guys do it. I mean, they, you know, I'm just staying home. Guys, we can't do that. We can't do that anymore. That's my tendency. 52 years old, I could see myself just saying, okay, whatever. Our relationship with God is way, way, way too important for that. And we'll pay with our family, we'll pay with our kids, we'll pay with our relationship with our wife, and hope, you know, and possibly for the rest of our life. If no one has access to you, most guys will, you know, the mass majority, if you ask who is your best friend, guys really have to hesitate. Well, I got this one guy who kind of knows me. I mean, really. Many women, many of the gals I know, they'll give you a list, you know. I never saw, and right, when you were in high school, did you ever have anybody, did you ever see guys fighting over who was their BFF? Girls will. I mean, I'm saying that as a compliment to you ladies. You're so good at this, and we're so not good at this. We're so stupid about this. But here's the point. When we isolate ourselves, we don't get in trouble by ourselves. I mean, eventually we'll be around somebody, but we just won't be around the right people. Autonomy is a myth. It's a trap. And autonomy is an unworthy goal because just when you think you are isolated and no one can touch you, you'll find yourself in a situation you shouldn't be in. So I just want to say, and I say this for everybody, you and I, we are created for community. We are. Why did Jesus say, what's the best, greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The guy only asked for one, but he said, and love your neighbor as yourself. He didn't ask for two, he asked for one. He says, your relationships with God and your relationships with people are so vitally important, Jesus couldn't even leave it out. So here's the truth of it, guys. Are we, now, and I want you to know, I'm not mad at you. I hope I didn't come across, you know, upset. I love you. I care about you. I want to help you. But I know what's on the inside of you because it's on the inside of me. And some of you, maybe you're younger in a different stage of life or whatever, but I know how we drift. And we need the thing that we want the least. And I mean that. And we need it most when we feel like we need it the least. Are you willing to give people who don't work for you and who don't need anything from you access to you? Are you willing to step into that uncomfortable community for the sake of the people you love, for the sake of the people who love you the most? That's why we're going to do this. That's why we're having some great opportunities coming, and I'm really excited about it. So let's bow.